this is a lot more than the last conference that I spoke at. I was speaking at the ACSI conference in Dallas 2 years ago on something very obscure, at least for ACSI. It was the Progymnus Mater, and I had one person show up to my seminar. So they put me on the last day, the last seminar, so everybody was getting out of town anyway. But I'm glad y'all here. I hope this will be beneficial to you. I am a techno geek, as evidenced by my laptop, my iPad mini, my Android Resound phone, and my Amazon Kindle reader that I have just with me on this trip. The other night, my wife and I were talking, and I said, right now, currently working in our house, there are 10 different computing devices going simultaneously. Three of them were charging because they were low on battery. So I love technology, and as I go through, I don't want you to hear me saying technology is evil. But I am going to bring up some what I think are fairly valid critiques on the use of technology and what technology tends to promote in human nature. And so we're going to look at what those problems are and kind of look at what the biblical solution to that is, and then some practical advice for you as you go back to your schools. Before we get started, I want to put things in perspective, though. I found this cartoon on, there's a website for computer geeks that does cartoons for nerds like me, that's called xkcd.com. Anybody ever been to that? Okay. All three of you. Way to go. You have just raised your nerd card to let me know. You've probably also been to Slashdot at some point in your life if you've been to that website. If you haven't, go there, because then you'll really be nerdy. What they recently posted on their website was a list of quotations dating all the way back to 1871 about people's reflections on the pace of life. And the reason I want to put this in perspective is we often feel like our technology is running away with us and that things are so different now that we're living in an age that has never existed before and we have problems that no one else has ever had before. Well, listen to this. 1871 from the Sunday Magazine. The art of letter writing is fast dying out. When a letter cost 9 pence, it seemed but fair to try to make it worth 9 pence. Now, however, we think we are too busy for such old-fashioned correspondence. We fire off a multitude of rapid and short notes instead of sitting down to have a good talk over a real sheet of paper. 1884 from the Medical Record. It is unfortunately one of the chief characteristics of modern business to be always in a hurry. In olden times, it was different. 1886. With the advent of cheap newspapers and superior means of locomotion, the dreamy, quiet old days are over. For men now live, think, and work at express speed. They have their mercury or post laid on their breakfast table in the early morning, and if they are too hurried to snatch from it the news during that meal, they carry it off to be sulkily read as they travel, leaving them no time to talk with the friend who may share the compartment with them. The hurry and bustle of modern life lacks the quiet and repose of the period when our forefathers, the day's work done, took their ease. And it goes on and on and on and on. Almost every year from there until 1915 is the last quote they have. And they're all the same. And any of the books that you read on the pace of technology now will have much of the same kind of commentary. I say all of that because you're going to hear me say things about busyness, about speed, about rudeness, and all of them are true, but they weren't created by computing devices. They're created by the sin in our hearts. The problem with our technology is that it just enables us to make that sin much more broadly accessible to other people. And so we have to be careful about the way that we use it. The other problem that we have is really since, I'm gonna set the bar at 1999 with the advent of the movie The Matrix. Ever since that movie, we have begun to think and talk about ourselves as if we are machines. How many of you have wished at points in your life that you had something you could jack into the back of your skull download all the knowledge you needed for a class, for something that you were about to do, for cooking that you were going to do at home, whatever it was, you could just download it all into your brain and be done. We've begun to think of ourselves as computers, and so we begin to see ourselves in terms of efficiency. Start with a little thought experiment here. This was from a recent Wired magazine article about one of the gurus in Silicon Valley who is revamping businesses by teaching them the art of meditation. If you had to vote, what would you say is wrong with everything that's going on here, quote and picture? If you can't see the quote, it says, "Meditation and mindfulness are the new rage in Silicon Valley. And it's not just about inner peace. It's about getting ahead." Yes. Well, and even the meditation is a technique designed to help you be more efficient in business. We'll see why that's a problem in just a minute. The way I've divided all of this up is looking at what it means to have virtue in our virtual age. And so we're going to go through some of the problems that I think our technology creates, or at least exacerbates. And then we're going to look at the prescription from Scripture. And then I'll end with some final thoughts that are kind of practical notes for you to take back home with you. So, first, indifference. A lot of the quotes you're going to see as we go through this are from a book by Quentin Schultz called Habits of the High-Tech Heart. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. Like I do with my blog, I've kind of curated some of the best quotes for you so you can get a sense of what the book is about. He says in his book, "If we engage in trivial messaging all day long, we can temporarily push the broken world out of our minds and away from our hearts. Over time, we can become indifferent to the stories of our neighbors, family members, co-workers, and fellow citizens." Much like the critique from 1886, right? You're sitting on the train reading your paper and not talking to the people around you. If you flew here, how many of y'all were on an airplane to get here? How many of you talked to the people sitting around you through most of the trip? A couple. How many of you were engaged in some sort of digital device, except when they told you to turn it off and put it under your chair? Right? And even if you're not engaged in some device, usually we get very apprehensive about talking to people in large groups, in travel situations, on elevators. There's lots of different places. We just don't talk to people anymore. And one of the things is we have so much that can distract us that we become indifferent to what's going on in the world around us. You're around teenagers for more than 2 seconds, you realize this is the world they live in. They're very engaged, just not with anything that's going on right around them. They have a massive social life they're trying to manage, but they are indifferent to the people that are immediately in their vicinity for the most part. And so one of the problems that the ubiquity of technology creates for us is that it makes us unaware, indifferent to the things going on around us. So, I told you we were going to do this physically, everybody pulling out their cell phones. Take your phone, I'm going to do mine too. And I want you to actually turn it all the way off. Not vibrate, not silent. Actually, yeah, not airplane mode. Not any of those things. Literally all the way, so that if you want to take the battery out just to prove that you really did it, that's great. And I'm going to use a quote from one of the pioneers of virtual reality, Jaron Lanier. If you've never read anything about or by this guy, you should. He wrote a book that's in my recommended reading called You Are Not a Gadget. And one of the things he said at a conference that he spoke at was, "I don't want you to tweet or update anything in the middle of my talk." And here's why. "If there's anything that I say that so angers you or pleases you that it's worthy of being tweeted or talked about later on, then you will have had time to process it and it will become yours." Rather than you're just living in the moment of updating the immediate and not thinking about what it is you're hearing. You're not indifferent to the world around you if you wait. So that's what we're going to practice today. We'll see how it goes. Not that I'm really expecting any of y'all to tweet anything that I'm saying. Just, I thought it was a good quote. All right. So we have indifference. I know you've never seen this in any of your students or ever used your technology for this purpose. Netflix, I'm looking at you. Right? Entertainment. This is from Lanier's book. Vapid video pranks and lightweight mashups may seem trivial and harmless, but as a whole, this widespread practice of fragmentary, impersonal communication has demeaned interpersonal interaction. How many of y'all have gone on a field trip with a student or a group of students, and you've asked them to turn off their phones or to leave their phones at home or whatever it is, and they look at you like you've lost your mind? We used to take a trip when I was working at a school in Virginia. We used to take a trip every year to D.C. with our seniors. And we required them to turn off their cell phones on the way up there. And they were like, what are we going to do? And this was before iPods. How are we going to keep in contact with people? How are we going to... It's like, you're going to talk to each other. And you're going to like it. Not only that, I can almost guarantee you that by the time you get back to school, your favorite part of the trip will have been the car ride. And almost every time it was true. Because they weren't so busy with their mind frittering from thing to thing, they were able to have fun and real conversation with their friends, and they enjoyed it. Stress. More and more studies are coming out about the amount of stress that the sheer quantity of information that we receive creates in our lives. And here's two different quotes from Schultz's book. Consequently, we are drowning in a deepening sea of fragmented, trivial, and incoherent information. Our insatiable desire for information results in moral confusion, not virtue. We think that the more that we get, the better off that we're going to be. The problem is, it's kind of like going to one of those delis where they have too many options on the menu. And you just go, I don't know, pick something for me. You just run out of ways that your mind can put everything together quickly, and so you give up. That's essentially what happens with us and with our students because of the amount of information they process on a daily basis. You may or may not realize this. Most of your students have a Facebook page. They have a Twitter account. They have an Instagram. They probably have profiles on several other social media websites. My guess is, in the midst of all of that, they have some other identities that they're managing so that their parents don't know. And they're trying to do their normal schoolwork and their daily social activities and athletics that go along with what they're required to do. Imagine you could never escape junior high. That you always had the constant criticism, the constant yammering of everybody telling you what they thought about everything that you did and determining how popular you were by the number of people that liked you. That's social media. It's the eternal junior high, right? It's quantifiable popularity, and it creates a great amount of stress in the lives of our students. And it creates less for us because most of us have gotten to the point where we care less about what people think. We still care. But we're not, hopefully, constantly checking it every 5 minutes. Here's another one from Schultz's book. He's quoting Dorothy Bass. Remote from the natural world and wired into a workplace that never shuts down, we are in danger of slipping into an existence that is always winter and never Christmas. That we can't get away from the things that we do, and so we never really rest. We have all of the downsides of winter with none of the upsides. It's like being in Texas in the summer without a swimming pool or an air conditioner. I'm sure you've never seen this in yourself or any of your students when it comes to using technology, but there tends to be an impetuousness that goes along with the use of modern technology. Speed is good, right? If I've got this sorry old Verizon Resound phone that is a year and a half old, I need to upgrade it, right? Because faster is better. And there's got to be something faster than this already on the market. And if I'm not faster, I'm not as productive. Today, we increasingly assume that doing things quickly and effectively is more important than doing them carefully, thoughtfully, and ethically. We don't think about how we're doing things, just how quickly we're doing them. Can I get it done in less time so I can move on to the next thing? Or can I do multiple things simultaneously so then I'm really productive? And we have this myth of multitasking that we're going to be the guy, you know, here we go. I'm doing home and work all at the same time, doing them all well. And more often than not, we're just stressing ourselves out and we're not doing anything well. I don't have a quote for this one because I don't really need one. Any of y'all heard of this website yet? Or app? Ask.fm? Has anybody had any experience with that? Your kids have, especially junior high kids. What happens is they create a profile, and usually they link it because most parents are not, I was going to say foolish, but They've decided that they're not going to give their kids full access to the internet in 7th and 8th grade, necessarily. But they give them limited stuff like an iPod Touch that has wireless access to it. And so they can create Instagram accounts and things like that. Well, they link these ask.fm profiles to their Instagram, and it basically says, ask me a question, and then has their username for ask.fm. The problem is anybody can go to their ask.fm profile and ask them a question completely anonymously. I just had a parent come in my office the 1st of June, and we'd been out of school for a couple weeks already. And she brought me 60 pages of printouts from one girl's ask page. 60 pages of questions and answers. I would say a good 45 of those 60 pages were sexually explicit questions, or they weren't questions at all, they were just abuse. This is what our kids are inundated with. This is the world that they live in. That, again, it's eternal junior high. Now, in this case, it actually was a junior high girl that was going through this. Do you know about Instagram? Okay, so you take a picture and you can modify it, and then you put it out there for everybody that follows you on Instagram to see. Well, what they do is in the description part of their profile on Instagram, they put their ask.fm profile name. And basically, you can either click on it or just go and type it in. And you go to this page, and it just has a form for you to ask a question, and then they can respond to it. So if I put on my Instagram profile, ask me a question, you know, AB Gentry 62, you would go and find that on the ask.fm page or in their app, and you could ask me a question, and it would allow you to either let me know who you are, if you're one of my friends, or not. And so what happens, especially for attractive young girls, is you get people, I mean, there were people that were asking questions. A couple people had linked their profiles to their questions, and they were from England, from places in Europe, I mean, all over, had no knowledge of this girl at all, but were asking her very explicit questions. What's your bra size? What sexual things have you done? Would you do this with me? And then you had a whole slew of things that just said things like, you're a slut. Because they saw those questions on her profile, they just thought, hey, that'll be fun. I'll beat her up for even answering some of these questions. Because she had not listed it as private, yes. So, Instagram, they do the same thing, especially in junior high. we had kids this year. We had one that created a profile pretending to be another student and made comments so that it would look like that student was a lesbian, so that her friends would stop talking to her. We had students that were taking pictures of classmates at inopportune times and then posting basically kind of rating systems for their friends to go and rate how stupid they looked in the pictures. It's just, I mean, they'll find ways to be rude with the technology. Twitter, we got involved with a Twitter war with the baseball team of one of our rivals in baseball, which that stayed pretty innocent, thankfully, but oftentimes they do not. Y'all know about Snapchat? If you don't know about Snapchat, it's an application that allows you to do picture messaging. That it's kind of like Mission Impossible, that when you get the picture, it says this message will self-destruct in 5 seconds, and you have that long to look at it, and then it disappears. Well, you can imagine what teenagers use it for. Yeah, sexting is a big part of the Snapchat world because they think that no one will find their picture later on. Well, here's the interesting thing. If I get a Snapchat on my phone and I happen to have my iPad handy, I just pull out the camera and go click, and suddenly I've got that picture and it doesn't go away, and I can forward it to as many people as I want to. That's a problem. Now, you can also do, y'all know how to take a screenshot on your phone? You can screenshot the Snapchats, but it'll actually notify the person if you do that. So they think they're safe because they know if somebody saved their picture, but not if you do it that way. And again, they send it out. Anybody seen the new movie Disconnected? Or Disconnect, I think is what it's called. It's got Jason Bateman and several other people in it. It's very raw. It's very R-rated. So I'll just throw that out there to start off. But it's basically it could have been an after-school special about bad internet use. Because it really shows you in a gritty way the consequences of living in a world where you have no responsibility to someone else and how that all comes home to roost eventually. So if you can handle that kind of stuff, I would recommend it as a way of just kind of getting yourself familiar with the ways these things can go bad. And I put this up there because if you spend any time on any website and you go and read the comment page, you have what are called trolls. People that go around intentionally just trying to be rude and get people mad. And so rudeness is everywhere on the internet. And it's easy because we allow anonymity. You can create a profile that no one will know who you are, or you can just post and no one will know who you are. It takes away any kind of responsibility that you might have. This one's a little more abstract than the others we've been talking about, but one of the things that comes out of what Schultz calls an informationist mindset is that we value quantity over quality. It doesn't matter how good something is, it just matters that we keep getting more of it, that we have faster bandwidth, that we have more information, that we have more hits on our blog, whatever it is, we're looking for greater quantity. It says, informationism derails any quest for moral wisdom by emphasizing the is over the ought, observation over intimacy, and measurement over meaning. C.S. Lewis deals with this a lot in Mere Christianity. If we buy into a naturalistic world, which informationism does, because it believes that machines, specifically computers, are the solution and remedy for human suffering, right? They can create suffering, but they also can alleviate that suffering if we get them fast enough and powerful enough. And so you get this kind of naturalistic worldview, this mindset that says all there is the stuff that we build, and we are going to build ourselves into utopia. It's kind of the Star Trek mentality, right? We'll eventually advance technologically enough that we'll get rid of greed, we'll get rid of poverty, all of those kinds of things. And the problem is once you go into that mindset, you think of only what exists out there as what should exist. Because you don't have a definition of should anymore. Ought goes out the window. You don't think about meaning. You just think about more stuff, more ways of doing what you've already been doing and doing it better. But you don't have a content to better. It just better just means I got have more of it. And so upgrades are best. We are particularly hopeful that more efficient and powerful messaging systems will improve the quality of our lives. Why do you want an ugly beige computer that probably is running some, you know, old Pentium 2 processor? If you don't know what that is, it's one of the early processors for those of you that are under 30. When you could have, well, yeah, I had one of the 486 processors in one of my first computers, and my dad had, he worked for an oil company, and he had one of the first portable computers, which was basically a little larger than this with a handle on it and a flip-down green and black screen with an attached keyboard. And the ad, I wish I had gotten the ad to show you, but the ad is great because it shows this businessman boarding a plane and the flight attendant sitting there smiling at him and he's grinning and he's carrying this giant machine. Like, look how technologically advanced and wonderful I am. As he steps onto the plane. There's no way that thing would have fit in any plane seat or even in the overhead compartment. But why do you want boring beige box when you can get shiny black Alienware computer that can play games and do all the things that it does? Well, the reason you want more is because, especially in Web 2.0 world, we learn the art of marketing yourself. And this is more important than you realize, because a lot of the things that we buy into, Google, Facebook, almost every web page that's out there that doesn't cost anything, comes from someone marketing you somehow. Meaning, Google's not in this for the benefit of humanity. They're in it for money. Even though they say their catchphrase, their motivation for doing things is don't be evil. Their real motivation is make more money. The reason they keep buying up new technologies and finding all of these ways to extend their world is because the more they know about what you do, the better they can target ads and the more they can charge for those ads. They're not just doing it because they think you look pretty or because you're a nice person. They want to make money off of you. And they are willing to market you. And so people have just decided, well, I'll market myself. I'll figure out what I can do that I can promote myself. And Web 2.0 is kind of based on that whole idea. The whole social networking, LinkedIn, Facebook, all of those. You build the connections, and the reason you build those connections is to promote you. Why do you have a blog? So people can learn all of the wise things that you have to tell the world. We can talk about cyberspace as a global village as if it unifies the world into a community. But our actual uses of cyber technology suggest that we select our online affiliations to maximize our own narrow interests, not to reach out beyond those interests. One of the things that's interesting about the rise of the internet culture is everybody thought it would unite the world in peace and harmony when they first laid it out there. And you can read some of the guys that helped design the internet. And that they were operating under that mentality. Again, a very Star Trek kind of mentality that poverty is going to go away, everyone's going to rejoice, we'll all be at peace. But this last election is a great example of what happens over time when you leave people to themselves. They look out for themselves and their own interests, and they band together only with those people that share and promote their interests. And so it's very easy to divide and conquer. Because I'm going to give you what you want, and so you're going to like me. And then I'll give you what you want, and you're going to like me. But you don't know that what you like and what you like is exactly opposite, and that I'm willing to just pander to whichever one I want to get what I want. Because I'm helping you get what you want. And this is not a Democrat thing. It's not a Republican thing. It's a modern thing. That we are so fragmented because of the way we use our technology that it's so easy to pick us off. And I'm not saying that to scare you. I'm saying that so that you realize the vision for what technology was intended to be is not always what it becomes. And we have to be cognizant of that, especially as we're introducing it to our students in school. All right, I call this last one Endless Possibility because that fits better on this screen. But I like this title better. Why do I do something? Because I can. This was, by the way, like my motto in college. And not in a licentious way. I worked with, my roommate in college was one of the first guys to work in a tech department. And he helped lay cable for the school because they had never really had much technology before. And so we had access to technology that none of the other students on campus did. And we had access to technology that was well beyond what most other people had at that time. Broadband was not something that most people had in their homes. And we had a T1 connection to the internet. We downloaded The Matrix before it ever came out in theaters. It didn't have the soundtrack, but that didn't bother us. Why did we do it? It wasn't like we really had some burning desire to go sell The Matrix online or anything. We could, so we did. Why did we hack into the sports Excel spreadsheet that had all the scholarships for all the athletes using the password sports? Because we could. We weren't doing anything nefarious with it. We just wanted to see if we could get in there. And it was so easy, right? And our use of technology, and when we get into the mindset of, look at all the amazing things that my phone or my tablet or my laptop or whatever can do, is we slip into this mindset. How many of y'all have seen the Galaxy S4 commercials with the video pausing when you look away? Right? Or the one that's making fun of all the Apple people standing in line and all the Samsung folks are doing all these cool things and everybody's like, when are we going to get that? Right? There's never a question of should we be putting all these things in our phones. It's just, when do I get it? I want to be able to do that too. We have to guard against that. Now, the reason that I put these, and you could probably think of some other things that you think, there's actually bigger problems that technology creates. The reason I created them this way is because we're going to contrast them with the fruit of the Spirit. I don't have fancy slides for all the fruit of the Spirit because I ran out of time. I went to bed at 1:30 last night and still wasn't done with my PowerPoint. So you get pretty good first side, and then you just have to listen to me talk on the second side. So, but I'm hoping that you are more familiar with the fruit of the Spirit than with some of the concepts we've already talked about. What is the measure that counters indifference? The spiritual fruit of love. Love others as you love yourself. Love your enemies. They will know you are Christians by your love. Just read anything that John wrote, right, in Scripture. What does he harp on over and over and over again? We are to be a people marked by love. Not someone that just goes, oh yeah, there's a person near me, but what I'm doing on my phone or tablet is more important. Even if it's inconvenient to us, we are to be people who love. Especially if it's inconvenient to us, we are to be people who love. And in this, Christ demonstrated his love for us, right? What did he do? He was willing to die on the cross so that we might have life, right? You wouldn't think that the opposite of entertainment is joy. But what do we do when we're entertaining ourselves? Are we experiencing joy typically? How many of y'all have read Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death? If you haven't, I recommend it. I don't like everything in there, but I like a lot of it. It's kind of like what he said about Plato earlier. He He gets a couple things wrong, but he gets a lot right. And he traces even the root of the word amusement. And it's setting aside inspiration and basically shutting our brains off. And think about the way that we experience most of our entertainment. Whether it's streaming a video from Netflix, whether it's playing a game on our phone while we wait in line somewhere, whatever it is, it's not designed to bring us this deep and abiding joy. It's there to shut our brains down so we don't think about the horrible line we're standing in with no air conditioning or whatever else it is that we're trying to put aside. As opposed to the type of joy that C.S. Lewis writes about over and over and over again. The joy that gives us a sense of sadness because there's something that we just can't quite grasp a hold of because it's so real and so true and so good and so beautiful that we want more of it, but we can't recreate it on our own. That sense at the end of the Chronicles of Narnia, where they go into Aslan's land and they see this is what we've been waiting for, and they experience that true and deep and abiding joy. It's so much better than entertainment. Contrary to stress, fruit of the Spirit is peace. That we are able to rest and rest with joy, and that we are able to live in harmony with the people and things around us. It's true shalom, right? We sang about it this morning. Instead of it being impetuous, we should be patient. How many of you get frustrated when it takes more than about 2 seconds for your phone to bring up a web page or find an address or do voice recognition or whatever it is that you're trying to do? And then you think back, any of you that have done computing for more than about 5 years, right? I remember one of my first computers, I would click on a web page, and there were no pictures for this web page to load, really. It was just some text. But I could go, like, make myself a snack, go to the bathroom, go talk to somebody, and come back, and it was mostly done by then. We kind of skew our idea of what we need to wait on. And again, we think that if we're faster, we're somehow going to be better. But think about how that plays out in most people's professional life. How do you do if all you do is try to run through quickly all the tasks that you've been assigned? What happens when your kids in your class do that? Yeah, you hand it back to them and say, you rushed through this, you need to redo it. The opposite of rudeness is kindness. You don't have to like everybody. You do have to love them. You don't have to be best friends with everyone, but you do have to be kind. And the result of the Spirit working in our hearts is that we don't want to be anonymous. We don't want to be distanced from other people so that we can say and do whatever we want to. How am I doing on time here? Okay. How many of you have seen the movie Hollow Man with Kevin Bacon? Wow, you really are, like, getting the nerd card going. I love it. It's an awful movie. Like, it's not well done. It's a cheesy plot. It's basically The Invisible Man. But what happens in the course of that movie is Kevin Bacon is a scientist who discovers a way to make himself invisible. And at first, as you can imagine, what does he do? He plays around with other people in the lab and does cool things because they can't see him. But what quickly begins to happen as he realizes that no one sees him is that he begins to lose the moral compass that has guided him, however tenuous it was, up to that point. And so he begins sneaking into women's hotel rooms. He begins stealing things. It just becomes this thing where he spirals out of control because he has no accountability. Kindness only comes when there is knowing. We won't be kind if we don't have relationships. The reason there's so much rudeness on the internet is the same reason there's so much rudeness on the road. the technology cuts us off from the people around us. The reason you get mad when somebody cuts you off in traffic is because you assume you know what they're thinking and that it's directed at you. The reason you get mad on the internet when you see something you don't like is because you don't know the person, and so you're just going to spew all over them because it offends you. It's very me-centered, and relationship helps take care of that. It helps create kindness. Instead of the idea of quantity being the greatest virtue, the fruit of the Spirit says, no, quality is what we should be looking at. Goodness is what we should be looking at. Holiness is what we should be striving for. This may be a stretch, but the upgrade mentality is, this is only good to me as long as it's useful. After that, I discard it and don't think about it anymore. Problem is, we do that long enough with enough things, we start to do it with people too. We only view them for the utilitarian purpose they have in our lives. And we quickly get to the point where we discard the people that are not useful to us. But if our primary goal is goodness, then we're going to try to cultivate that relationship, that kindness, and we're going to be much more likely to be faithful to the people that are in our lives because we have something that binds us to them. But it only happens in person. It's very, very hard to create a binding, lasting relationship with somebody that you're never in their presence. This was driven home to me long before I got all of this technology. When I was in college, my roommate was dating a girl. We were in Jackson, Mississippi, and she was at Texas A&M. And my roommate was a very popular guy. He had all these girls that wanted to hang out with him. And I remember one night in the dorm room, he called her and he said, "This can't continue like this. Either you transfer here, because I don't have the money to transfer there, or we've got to break up." She loved him enough that she said, "Okay." And she transferred. They got married. But had that not happened, and I know there's plenty of cases of people who've made long-distance relationships work and blah, blah, blah. Typical human communication and relationship does not happen at a distance. Think about the times you get yourself in trouble in the education world. It's when you try to deal with a problem without actually dealing with the problem. You try to do it remotely. You send an email or a text when you should have done a face-to-face conversation. You have to demonstrate faithfulness to the person, an attachment to them, a willingness to work through the hard stuff in order to create a longer and lasting relationship. And it's easier to do that when you do it with gentleness. I've had some very hard conversations with people over the last 10 years in education. I've been dean of students for most of that time. I've also been an elder in my church. When you have a lady in your church call you while you're supervising a high school dance and say, "I need to talk to you. I've been cheating on my husband with one of the other elders." You don't send her a text and say, "Hey, don't do that anymore." Or, "LOL, that sounds like a problem." Right? You sit down and you have hard conversation, but gentle conversation. A conversation that says, we are all sinners. We are all lost. We are all in need of salvation. And you need to turn from your sin, because if you don't, it will destroy you. But I will love you through that, and so will God. That's gentleness. It's not self-promotion. You don't get anything out of that. You don't go out and create a blog saying, "Look at my 7 ways of helping people who have cheated on their husband." You don't put yourself forward, you put the other person forward. Even if it means you take a hit to your own reputation, your own social life, your own whatever it might be, you're willing to approach them with gentleness and humility rather than self-promotion. And instead of the "because I can" mentality, We have self-control. Sometimes you just need to say no. Y'all don't know this about me unless you happen to be at the one other SEL conference where I did something in 2004, and I weighed about 40 pounds more. But 2 years ago, one of my coworkers looked at me and he goes, "Dude, you're going to have a heart attack." And he's probably right. What sent him over the edge and decided to have him have that conversation with me is I was drinking the melted butter that came with my fajitas. I was that guy. And my biggest problem was self-control. I just was indulging whatever appetite, in this case a literal appetite, came to mind. If I wanted a milkshake, I went out and got a milkshake. If I wanted melted butter, I drank it. If I wanted to eat the whole thing of guacamole in one sitting, I did. It was bad. And I still struggle with the idea, especially when you have a buffet like we have for SEL, to go through that line and just put what you need, not what you want. Because I could. I could pile that thing 2 miles high and eat all of it. Although now God has also cursed me with heartburn. So if I try it now, there's dire physical consequences that go along with that. But instead of saying, "It's possible, therefore I can," we look at it and say, "Should I?" And so we don't just operate according to the is, we operate according to the ought. Okay, we've got, 5 minutes? Is that right? What time do we get out of here? 3:45? I think it's 3:45. How many of y'all are planning on going to the forum at 4 o'clock? Okay, if I end up going over time, feel free to slip out. You won't offend me. I'm hoping I'll get us done way before that, though. Yes. Yeah, many of you don't. There's this ancient technology. It's called an analog watch. There's these things called hands, and they point at numbers, and it tells you what time it is. I think we've got about 5 minutes till we're technically supposed to end. So, all right, so how do we cultivate virtue online? What are some practical things we can do? First, we must continuously ask the question, are we filling a true need or just responding to good marketing? Do I need an iPad mini? Or is my regular iPad just fine that I bought 6 months ago? Do I need an iPad? Or is my laptop okay? Do I need a laptop? Or is my desktop, as clunky as it may be, serving the purpose that I need for the things that I need to do? Keyword there is need in all of those sentences. Yes, can I put a handle on my desktop and carry it on a plane with me? Which, this same friend that I keep telling you about, that was my roommate in college, he was one of those guys that, he was really great at asking this question. I'm not going to get it just because some marketer tells me to, but I may build it myself. And so long before people were installing MP3 players as part of their car stereo systems, he built a computer in the trunk of his car using a FedEx box and a circuit board and had a line running up under the seats to the front so he could play his digital music as he drove around because he didn't want to afford any inexpensive kind of stereo system. Yeah, this was the guy that, like, he could have created an entire room out of bungee, too. So he's just one of those guys you want to know. But we need to be careful that we're not buying in on lots of levels to marketing, that we're not just doing it because we've gotten a good sales pitch, or that we're not selling ourselves cheap. Again, Google is the great example of this. And I'm telling you this, I have a Gmail account. Our school email is basically the Gmail brand with our domain over it. But Google is in there to make money off of you. How cheap are you willing to sell yourself? I thought this was interesting from Schultz's book. A caring institution seeks a goodness beyond what is required for organizational self-preservation or simply for parity with other institutions. If you haven't had this conversation with a parent yet, you will. such and such school has given all of their kids iPads. When are we going to do it? If you're just doing it to keep up with the Joneses, or the Catholics, or the whatever is the major dominant school that gives out the iPads in your area, you're not doing it for the right reasons. We have been examining philosophically at our school, and this is how I got involved in a lot of this, is I was the one saying, wait, we don't just want to start saying which tablet do we want to hand our students. The question we need to ask is, do we want to hand a tablet to our students? What are we fundamentally changing about education at our school and the community that we're creating when we do this? And unless we can answer that question, we have no business handing out anything to anybody. And I would argue that's the same thing that your school should think about. What is your goal in doing it, and what will you change when you do it? We also need to think about things differently. We need to think about engagement, not just productivity. There was another recent article that came out. Two magazines that I love subscribing to are Wired Magazine, which is all about technology's wonderful, blah, blah, blah. And I read it to get that side of things. But The Atlantic Magazine. If any of y'all haven't subscribed to The Atlantic, I recommend it. They have some of the best writing of any magazine that's out there. And my wife, we read World Magazine at our house, too. I don't know if you know about that one. It's written from a Christian perspective and tends to be a little rah-rah for the Republicans on a lot of things. And I have nothing against the Republicans. It just gets a little over the top at times. But what The Atlantic does is it takes an idea and really goes in depth with it. Like, you're not looking at a one-page article or a two-page article. You're talking like 17 pages. You're going through going, ooh, this... It's almost over. No, wait, there's 5 more pages. And I love that because it doesn't just do a short kind of overview of something. You really get to delve into it. Well, they just did one not too long ago. I'll pull it up for you. But of course. It's okay. We can fix that. The one rule I have learned with technology, always have a backup plan. Because if you don't, you're dead in the water. We have smart boards at our school. I don't know if y'all have tried any of those at any of your schools. Smart boards are great when they work. But if you've planned your entire lesson based on a smart board and the projector dies or somehow the interface isn't working or some other quirky thing that you've never seen before, then your whole lesson's dead and you have to improvise. Okay, so this whole article, Machines Can't Flow, the Difference Between Mechanic and Human Productivity, basically says, starting with the Industrial Revolution, one of the things that we began to do is to think about human productivity as if we are machines. We've already talked about that a little bit. And what that means is the way that we measure the productivity of our students, of ourselves, is how much we can get done in a given time frame. It's basically a time-oriented, time-pushed productivity. Whereas if you talk to somebody like a heart surgeon, they're not trying to see how many hearts they can operate on in one day, right? If it takes them all day to operate on one person and do it right, they're going to do it. They're engaged with the task that they're involved in at that moment. So it's engagement, not productivity. I had worked for a professor when I was in seminary, and he used to go down to Brazil and teach at a seminary that was down there on a regular basis. And the thing that always threw him off about going to the seminary down there is he would get in on whatever flight he got in on, and then he was supposed to speak at like 7:30 at night. Well, he would show up 7 o'clock, not a soul there. Well, there might be one guy that had, come on early to set things up, but otherwise it was empty. 7:30, there were a couple people. By 8 or 8:30, most people had generally gotten there. By 9 o'clock, he could start. And it took him a while to figure out what the problem was, and the problem was his expectation. he was viewing time from an American way of looking at time, which was, the clock says 7 and I'm supposed to start at 7, we start at 7. Whereas in Brazil, their priority is the person they're with at the moment. So if I'm in a meeting with you and we're running long, I don't go, well, our time is up, I got to be somewhere else. I just keep talking and you keep talking and we have our conversation. And whenever we get done, and then I go to the next person, and they're not upset that I've been rude to them, because they've probably done the same thing themselves. They're engaged with the person that they're talking with, they're engaged with the subject that they're involved in, rather than worrying about just being productive and following a set schedule. Now, having said that, American economy would crumble if we went to that system. It just would. We can't just go, okay, well, we're going to give up on time, throw our clocks out the window and all become Brazilians. But I think we can make adjustments to the way we engage with our schedule and build in time so that we can properly engage with the people and the subjects that we're involved in. And we can teach our students to do the same. Which means we might not get to everything in our curriculum, but we'll engage deeply the things that we do. I think I closed my presentation. Yes. All right. We also need responsible leaders who will think deeply not just about where we're going, but why we're going there. This is true of y'all who are leading schools now, and it's true of what you should be training your students to be doing. You don't just want them to say, where are we going? It's kind of like Alice when she's walking through the woods in Alice in Wonderland and the Cheshire Cat shows up and she goes, can you tell me which way to go? And he says, well, where are you headed? I don't really know. Well, then it doesn't matter where you go. Just start walking. If we don't know why we're doing what we're doing, it doesn't matter where we go. Because we're going to create all sorts of damage and destruction in the process if we don't, either accidentally or on purpose. We need to know not just where we're headed, but why we're headed there. And we need to raise a generation of people that will think deeply about the why of the things that we do. Two more slides and we're done. Working with students, we have to help them see that intimacy and knowledge that they crave only comes through dialogue and shared experience. You cannot know someone just by reading the small snippets shared on social media, shared with little context. Knowledge does not come from a tweet. Knowledge comes from a relationship that is created out of a shared context over time. And there is no easy way to short-circuit that process and create a relationship fast. Relationships, by their very nature, take time. Another option, things you can do, teach debate. Argument that requires systematic logical thought, not hurried fire hose blasts of information. Kind of like what I'm doing with you today. I'm blasting you with lots of information. And this whole conference kind of does that. It's kind of the conference style. And then you have to go kind of process it later on. But how are you teaching your students to argue? Are they just going to overwhelm their opponents with lots of information? Or are they going to build a slowly constructed logical argument that holds up against critique? By the way, I also think this could play in, you could actually teach your kids to program computers and teach them to program this way. Lanier talks all about this in his book, You Are Not a Gadget. One of the problems we have with a lot of the software we have is that people did it without thinking about the consequences of what they're doing, which is why we have a lot of the stupid things we have in Microsoft Word and other things that we use. Because somebody was trying to fix this problem quickly, and they didn't think about the 10 other problems it was going to create down the road. Coding, you have to think through not just what you're doing right now, but how it's going to play out at the end. And that's a great kind of mind game for your kids to work through. Find ways for students to serve and interact with others in person. Take them on trips. Get them in front of other people they don't know. Stop referring to people as machines. You do this when you teach without even realizing it. Your kids do it all the time, too. Talk about downloading information, offline conversations, increasing our bandwidth. There's a million different ways that we do this. Yes. Start thinking about human ways of describing what it is we do. We are not machines. As Lanier says, you are not a gadget. One of the ways we can help our students is giving them times for silence and meditation. Just pause sometimes. When I was working at a school in Mississippi, I had seniors for 3 hours right before chapel. And the last 15 minutes before chapel started, we would just turn off the lights, stop class, and they would just sit quietly for 15 minutes before we went into chapel. We called it Be Still and Know That I Am God time. And we need that as Christians, and we need that as humans. We need that silence and that peace to get away from the busyness and noise that technology creates and makes us think that we need. One of the ways you can help them do that is something that I started when I was in Mississippi and have continued on, is assigning your students a technology fast. I would recommend you do it with them if you do it, so that they don't just think you're trying to torture them. Once in the spring and once in the fall, my students get to pick which one they do. They turn in to me their cell phones, their tablets, iPods, laptops, whatever. And if they don't turn it into me, they have to turn it into their parents and bring me a signed note saying that their parents have it so they can't use it. Then they journal all week long about what their week is like. And it always starts out something like this. Day one, what am I going to do? It's only 5 minutes after the bell has rung after school, and I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. I don't know what time it is because I don't have my phone. I don't know where my friends are. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with myself. Well, I guess I'll go eat. And it's usually something along those lines. By Thursday of that week, generally it takes on the tone like this. Well, no technology week isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I've gotten a lot more sleep this week. I've gotten all my homework done. And I had some really good conversations with my friends and with my parents. And what they realize by the end of the week is they actually enjoy their lives without technology, because they're engaging in things that their mind doesn't normally stop to enjoy. And just like fasting in Scripture, we need to take a break from our normal habits in order to reset sometimes. And if we're doing that on a regular basis, we're less likely to be captivated by the slavery of our devices and think more humanly about who we are and who we are in relation to God. All right, here's recommended reading. Like I said, if you send me an email, I will be glad to send all this to you so you have everything. But those are some great books. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to stay around for as long as you want. I know it's warm in here, and they've got the forum. So if you want to go, feel free. If you want to ask questions, stick around. Yes, I will. There it is.
Have you seen, is there a magazine, Fast Money, or something like that?
Yes.
You see that article they had a few weeks or a couple months ago about why you will not remember reading anything you read in this article? And it was all about the topology of books and how we don't have that on Kindles or iPads, and so we don't remember what we read on digitally.
Yeah.
Because we don't know. But when
you don't have the
books,
spatial.
It's in the top right-hand corner of this page.
And it's all the same.
Yeah, and it's all, right?
Yeah. I agree. I love that kind of stuff. Just kind of breaking it apart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we were going through this, I was thinking, could I give up all this stuff?